But let's proceed. The chair has made a ruling here that we proceed. Let's get Treasury to take us through all the issues. Are you responding or you are proceeding? Oh, okay. Monitoring emissions and reporting on them.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. On that, thanks to the question by the member. Just to clarify that we've got a legal instrument that compels industry to report in the form of National Greenhouse Gas Reporting Regulations. So these are the regulations that describe for what activities reporting of emissions must be done and who must report. And also it provides guidance on the methodologies to be applied when the industry has to quantify the emissions. So far, we have the first reporting cycle that started in 2018 using this legal instrument. The second reporting cycle will start in January 2019 and end in March 2019, and this will be happening annually. So far, this process is happening manually, but we are in the process of developing an automated system so that the 2020 reporting cycle will be facilitated through an automated reporting system. Thank you.
So, in summary, we know what industries are emitting. They are supposed to report. They are under obligation to report the level of emissions, and that we know. Okay. Treasury, so we're going to take us until the end, and then we'll open up for members and for the stakeholders to comment.
Thank you, Chair. So the carbon budget, carbon tax alignment was one of the main issues that we're responding to based on the last parliamentary consultation. And then, like Momo indicated, we put the carrot before the stick. So we've already implemented an energy efficiency savings tax incentive that was implemented in November 2013. And basically, what has been happening is business has been able, it's a very generous incentive where you can claim your tax deduction for any energy efficiency savings that you make on, we're not prescriptive on what projects you can implement. And when we came to Parliament, there was a request from stakeholders that can this be extended, because this is a sunset clause of supposed to end in December 2020. And we've since, we're going to extend the energy efficient savings tax incentive for the moment for the duration of the first phase. So that's up to end of 2022. And just to give you a snapshot of the different sectors that have actually claimed this tax incentive, so at the moment, our data indicates that we've spent at least about 3 billion rands on this particular tax incentive. And it is part of the, there was an issue, a question asked about the revenue recycling measures. It's one of the major revenue recycling measures we have for the carbon tax. And then in terms of taxation of liquid fuels, there was an issue with domestic aviation. So there's an international mechanism that is under the UNFCCC that's being implemented, a carbon offset reduction mechanism. And international aviation, I guess all airlines are supposed to start reporting their emissions data starting in 2019. And within the UNFCCC framework, they've agreed that the mandatory phase for aviation to use the offsets to offset their emissions will only start in 2027, but starting next year is going to be a voluntary phase until 2026. So for the that covers international aviation, but within the domestic aviation sector, we're also going to be covered by the tax. And what we've done is we've consulted with stakeholders on a mechanism to incentivize and also make sure that we align with that international mechanism, so that when the South African, the airlines because South Africa is going to be within the mandatory phase from 2027, there will be able to be a smooth alignment with what we're doing domestically. So for us to be able to incorporate elements of that international mechanism called COSIA, what we've done is within the current bill, we've increased the tax-free allowances for domestic aviation from 90 to 95%. And we're also going to allow them to use a performance allowance, because within the COSIA mechanism, there are four different measures, and two of the major ones is the carbon offsetting and the performance allowance, the performance measure. So this allows us to align with an international mechanism, which will ensure smooth transition for our domestic airlines. And then in terms of taxation of liquid fuels, it is going to, we indicated there was a comment about how this was going to be done practically, because within the bill we indicate that we are going to tax the liquid fuels through the current fuel mechanism. So what happens with the current fuel mechanism is we impose taxes at the refinery gate using what is called the duty at source principle. So for us to be able to implement and allow liquid fuels to benefit from the tax-free allowances that other sectors are also able to access, we've adjusted the bill to allow the basic tax-free allowance for liquid fuels to increase from 60 to 75%. So at the refinery gate, there will only 25% of the emissions will be taxed. And we've done this for all liquid fuels related emissions, and provisions for this are implemented within the Customs and Excise Act. And then there was an issue with waste related activities. There was a sort of like a misalignment in the way we're treating emissions from the burning of the use of waste or the burning of waste. So it's been raised with us that because remember, we say the AFOLU sec, the agriculture, forest, and other land use, and the waste sector are not within the carbon tax net currently. But comments from the stakeholders have shown that waste incineration activities, which also result in emissions, were excluded from the current tax net because of our exclusion of the AFOLU and the waste sectors. So we've corrected that misalignment by ensuring that waste incineration is going to be taxed at the same rate as other combustion emissions. So we've reduced the tax-free allowances from 100 to 90, and all the tax-free allowances that apply to combustion will also apply to waste incineration. And just for us to indicate that we are in discussions with DEA, and as soon as we continue developing robust mechanisms to measure the emissions from the waste sector, we would then be able to include them within the tax net.
Thanks, Memory. And just to say, these changes were made to Schedule 2 in the bill to clarify the level of allowances for domestic aviation and liquid fuels and waste. The last few issues is that we received comments on the use of the Customs and Excise Act and whether it's the right mechanism to use to administer the tax. And there were proposals for a separate Carbon Tax Administration Act. We engaged BUSA after the hearings, and our view was that shifting to a Carbon Tax Administration Act is not necessary. The reason for that is because the carbon tax, the base, is emissions, and this is basically classified as a commodity in terms of the World Customs Organization harmonized system classification. This means that the carbon tax is defined, emissions is defined as a good, and goods are usually administered in terms of the Customs and Excise Act. So it is our view that this is the best instrument that should be used for the administration. Secondly, it prevents us from setting up a whole new duplicate administration system when we can just piggyback on the existing system. there were some issues raised around the requirements for licensing of facilities, and it was argued that this is very cumbersome and is onerous on taxpayers. As per our previous response document and our feedback, this was noted by SARS, and they are willing to consider more innovative ways in which to streamline the process for licensing, and rather than doing it at a facility level, they could try and connect activities. So that is a concession that has been made on the part of SARS.
Okay. Just wanted to say, just on that, because when we were doing the bill, there's the whole money bill and what's happened. So we've had to split just one clause, which we will publish, which we'll release next week, I think, so that players can see what that would be. But that would be done in a normal budget process next year, but we will publish that this week.
So that essentially provides for the administration through the Customs and Excise Act. The second issue that was raised by taxpayers quite strongly across the board was that the initial proposal was for 6 monthly payments, provisional payments of the tax, and then a reconciliation in the following year, in line with the reporting or verification of omissions by DIA. The proposal was that you should have 1 payment of the tax, so we accepted that proposal, and the bill has been amended under payment of tax to allow for 1 annual carbon tax payment. And this is likely to, this will be due by 30th June of the following year for which that tax is, the emissions is reported. This is also aligned with the DIA reporting regulations. And lastly, Chair, we thought we'd provide an update on the NEDLAC process. So we've engaged as government with business and labor on a jobs mitigation and creation plan. There were about 7 meetings of the task team held to date, and it was basically from the government side, Treasury, Department of Environmental Affairs, Economic Development Department that formed part of this task team. We submitted an initial progress report of the work of the task team in August, and this report essentially covered those sectors that were identified that could be affected by the implementation of the tax, both in terms of job losses and job creation opportunities. In October, various constituencies presented proposals for the plans, linked to the various sectors, including energy, transport, the water sector, waste sectors. And from the government side, our proposals are basically based on a collaborative effort between various departments, including the Department of Environmental Affairs, Energy, Transport, Labour, and Science and Technology. The proposals were targeted to the energy efficiency sectors, building, including energy efficiency in buildings, waste, looking at a specific waste management flagship program that has been developed by the Department of Environmental Affairs, and the biodiversity and water sectors, so looking at expanding initiatives such as the existing EPWP Working for Water program that has the potential to create significant jobs. So those are the targeted sector-based proposals. There were also cross-cutting proposals that we developed in collaboration with Department of Labor and Science and Technology. For the labor-related initiatives, it was to work with industry to identify the skills requirements in terms of the transition that would be needed, linked to a shift to using new mitigation technologies, etc., and based on that to consider specific training interventions that could help with reskilling. The second area has been on research, development, and technology innovation. The Department of Science and Technology has various initiatives aimed at innovation in terms of biofuels, hydrogen, fuel cells, batteries for storage, And they were willing to engage with business through partnerships in terms of developing these initiatives and looking at sector support, probably through financial resources. So that's just a summary of what we've done. In terms of the work of the task team, there's been various presentations that has been made, so that's been the approach that has been taken. We just like to provide some feedback in terms of our discussions on these presentations. We've had various presentations by business. There were some challenges in terms of the presentations that were made, specifically around the jobs impacts. It was very difficult to assess from our side what these jobs impacts were due to. Was it the carbon tax or were there other factors? And most of the presentations did not present opportunities for mitigation and how sectors could transition and how this could help with job creation, which was a bit challenging in terms of assessing the impacts on jobs that were presented. As part of the work that was put forward in the task team, business undertook a study to assess the impacts of the tax on jobs. There was additional time allocated to business, and it was the view of government that that study would inform business proposals for the particular plan. And it was not a study that was undertaken for the task team. We agreed to note the study as the task team. However, we would like to raise the following concerns. One, the modeling approach that was used to assess the impacts of the tax, we did not agree with that approach from an economic perspective. The model was a static, linear model that assumed no changes in terms of prices, did not assume no technology substitution possibilities, and the option of mitigation measures. So the view was that this model was not dynamic and was therefore likely to overestimate the impact on jobs. So that was just our impression in terms of the presentation. Where we are at in terms of the process, based on the proposals that were submitted by the constituencies, our view is that, and which is Labour and business is in agreement with, is that there's significant convergence around the proposals submitted. We have agreed that the report would cover the combined ideas, proposals for the plan, and this will be there will be a process initiated around developing the plan that will take place as part of the Presidential Jobs Summit and the actual implementation of those measures that have been identified. The Secretariat has completed a draft report and we expected to finalize this by the end of November. We hope that this will be submitted to the committee before the end of the year. We actually have a meeting on Thursday to finalize that report and the proposals. And then lastly, just to give some update, complementary to the bill, there's a regulation that will be developed, so we thought it would be useful to give an update. There's a regulation on the carbon offset mechanism. The initial set of regulations was published in June 2016. It was consulted on with stakeholders, including specific workshops with BUSA and other stakeholders on the regulation. A revised regulation was published on the 12th of November, earlier this month, and the closing date for comments is the 14th of December. Thereafter, we will finalize that regulation. The second set of regulations is the regulations linked to the performance allowance, where companies need, industries were asked to develop benchmarks against which the performance allowance can be assessed. We've had various submissions from various sectors that are presented here today, including cement, iron and steel, paper and pulp. We even had a series of engagements with these sectors over the past year to consider their proposals, the methodologies for developing benchmarks and the values. The next step is that through the World Bank, we will review those proposals for the benchmarks, looking at the methodologies, the benchmark values, and the robustness of this. Following this evaluation, we will publish a set of benchmark values for purposes of the performance allowance, and this will be in a regulation. And lastly, for the trade exposure allowance, we will also publish a set of regulations that will outline the methodology for the determination of the trade exposure allowance for entities, as well as provide a list of particular sectors and the actual allowance that those sectors would qualify for. We hope to publish that by the end of this year.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for that. Can we get some comments, questions? Lady here from BUSA.
Thank you, Chair. And
next.
Thanks to Charlene as well. Just to clarify some points around the NEDLAC process, the terms of reference said that we should consider the socioeconomic impact assessment and World Bank report that it was based on, as well as the National Employment Vulnerability Assessments and Sector Jobs Resilience Plans. As business, we felt, and we have put on record both to Treasury at the time and in the NEDLAC process, that we felt the SAIS report did not cover adequately and did not model correctly the impact of the carbon tax, so we had issues with that. Unfortunately, the NEVA and Sector Job Resilience Plans are not complete. They're still being undertaken in a parallel process. It's in that context that business requested opportunity to do studies to look at the impact of the carbon tax, and government's concerns with that study was noted, as Charlene mentioned. We did also present preliminary presentations, which have been shared with the chairs of this committee, on what business felt the impact was. We could not look at what mitigation plans needed to be put in place without first assessing the impact. So that was the first step of the work. Business did present, and I just feel that Treasury's presentation misrepresented this slightly, business did present and come to the table with mitigation plans and what we feel should be taken. And as mentioned, I think, by Charlene, we have agreed in the NEDLAC process to develop a national jobs resilience and creation plan, which is being put under the work that's being done under the jobs summit. And correctly, as stated by Charlene, we hope to finalise that report later this week, which will then be shared with this committee as requested. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the report on the NEDLAC process. Any comment from the site? Gentleman at the back.
Thank you, Chair. Econometrics, before I continue with my question, we don't represent business, nor do we represent civil society. So in that sense, we're different from the concern that was raised earlier.
What do you represent?
Consulting. So our main interest is the integrity of the policy instrument from a climate change technical point of view.
Okay.
Which actually brings me to the question. It was clarified that the number of regulations that underpin the bill itself on the offsets and on the benchmarking were going to be published later, I guess this year and the next couple of weeks. And the one I was missing was on sequestration. One of the elements in the tax design is that if you sequester carbon, you can deduct that from the carbon you emit on the other side. But obviously that needs to be guided by a way to calculate and work that out. I would like to understand what the timing is for that part of the regulations underpinning the bill.
Okay. Timing. Honorable member, going.
That I wanted to say is that I think sometimes also the problem is that we're, I don't know why I keep saying that. is that I think we're sometimes operating, you know, from a place of sort of mutual suspicion. So just to go back to the point that I raised in the beginning is that, you know, of course I think we all know, for example, where Sasol comes from. You know, no one thought here that Sasol runs a bakery or something, you know. So when I raised the point, it was, you know, it was rather to say that I think there's a good normative point that, as not someone who's, you know, has technical expertise in the area, is worth thinking about and getting a proper answer to as to whether we haven't missed something if the reality is that the more you reduce your carbon emissions, effectively, you don't save the same in taxes per ton. So actually the more you reduce, the less you're saving in taxes per ton. And shouldn't we ensure that actually at every level you're making the same amount of tax savings per ton? And it might be the view that, no, you've already looked at that and actually this other way works best. But we're just looking for an explanation as to why actually that isn't perhaps the good idea that it sounds, you know, and that we shouldn't be so suspicious in these questions. Especially again in the second point about, it has been raised earlier by various members about, you know, who's for the poor and who isn't. And again, from, you know, if you're sitting from where I'm sitting, you obviously have certain presentations that have been made by Treasury about the likely socioeconomic impact, and then you read other socioeconomic impacts that say the impact would be quite different. So really, the way I see it is, I don't think that either side does not care about the poor, does not care about the environment. Rather, the discussion is, have we settled on the best course for trying to balance what's best environmentally and also what's best in terms of you know, job losses and the economy. So I'm just saying that's the perspective I'm coming from. It's just trying to balance and weigh different viewpoints and differing sources of different conclusions that have been reached. And I think equally from sound methodologies or practice. Well, at least what I'm hearing now is also there's discrepancy, each side accusing the other of not having sort of sound methods and flawed methodology. But at least what we're seeing is that there's research to support either argument. So now what I want to point out, secondly, is in Treasury's response, it seems to say that, yes, you recognize that South Africa's emissions are below the national benchmark trajectory, but be that as it may, due to growth forecasts, you still feel that if you look at GDP growth, that we are likely to reach those emissions by the year 2025. I'm actually just reading that from your particular report, so that should make sense. And so the question is that there remains some doubt about those growth projections and whether we actually will meet that growth in the view of the fact that there has been at least a recent history of constant downward growth revisions, and isn't risk to the downside when it comes to growth. I mean, how likely is it that that is something that would happen, and wouldn't it be better to see that in fact growth poses a serious risk to rising emissions? Because if that's what you're basing the emissions on, saying that, well, actually we are below the national benchmark trajectory, but our main source of concern is that actually as we grow there will then be further emissions, then surely we need to be a lot more circumspect about those growth projections and be quite sure that if we're going to take such a serious decision, that it actually is very likely that we're going to meet those growth forecasts, when in the past, at least in recent history, it seems that we are actually not meeting any growth projections that have been made by Treasury. And then the second concern is about, and I think we finished the presentation now, so you have reached there about revenue recycling. It wasn't a point that we dealt on for very long. But again, I come back to a point that I think has been raised in the past, that, again, please do indulge me if you feel we have the time, because I have also been looking at the fact that if we are going to say revenue recycling is so important and that any funds raised are going to actually go back into boosting the economy, so this tax is not going to be regressive as far as the economy is concerned, why is it then not a good idea to ring fence those funds for those very same revenue recycling purposes that you feel would be necessary to occur? If that is the intention of how these funds should be used, what is the danger then of ring fencing them for that very purpose that you've highlighted would be beneficial to make this actually a policy that would have
a positive impact on the economy. And then lastly, you did deal with the background or the global context in which this bill is being introduced, but I don't feel that we are still sufficiently answering the concerns about the fact that, it might be too strong wording to say that the international environment is taking climate change less seriously, but certainly it is a view shared by many that the US and China, in other words, the larger polluters globally are not equally coming to the table, and that Africa accounts for less than 1% of global emissions. And this is not about making a point of, well, if they're allowed to do something wrong, then we should also be allowed to do something wrong. No, that's not the perspective that I'm making the point in, but rather to say that their lack of serious commitment, if one can call it that, does pose or does present particular consequences for us. For example, that if they're not equally coming to the table, it does actually limit the space for mitigation from developing countries. It does make the cost of these mitigation strategies much more costly, and it does mean that there will therefore be more serious trade imbalances for us, considering that the rest of the world, or the global market that we're operating or trading in, doesn't have equally punitive measures. And how do we effectively address those points? And I'm sure you're going to feel, just lastly, that you have addressed all of these areas, but I'm just saying for us, those are still the sticking points that we feel we just haven't received convincing enough argument to really shift or move us. And even if you have argued them before, if you can just maybe address those points in particular, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope you are not suggesting that because China and the US are not coming to a party, therefore we shouldn't. Okay. Because there must be a global effort. And the system as it is now, we work on the nationally determined contribution, so each nation must make its contribution towards limiting global emissions. So this is our part. Everybody else must come to the party. Members, are you done? Okay, ESCOM, and then WWF.
Thank you, Chair. Gina Downs again from ESCOM. There was just one very specific issue we did raise at the last, through all these stakeholder consultations, and it is not in National Treasury's response document, and that was the question of the renewable energy premium that in this latest draft of 2017 suddenly ceases in December 2022. When we did state very clearly that our power purchase agreements with the REIPPPP projects are ongoing until 2038. And you will have seen it published in our annual financial statements that that body of projects is already costing us at the moment R2.22 per kilowatt hour compared to our average generation of around 80 cents per kilowatt hour. And I have not yet seen a response from National Treasury on why the arbitrary cutoff date of December 22 has suddenly been introduced. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So ESCOM really detests this arrangement with the independent power producers. Every given opportunity you get, you just run it in. Yeah, I don't know when are we going to move away from that paradigm in terms of thinking about transition to a low carbon economy. It looks like you want to stick to the status quo, irrespective of how much it costs to us, to the environment, to the future generations. I'm sure what you're presenting now about the cost, what it costs to generate by ESCOM and what it costs to buy from the independent power producers. That modeling has been looked at by Cabinet, by Energy Department and the Minister before they came to that determination about how much it costs now and how much it's going to cost in the future. So one was hoping that, you know, with Eskom as a public utility, you're going to help us, you know, to meet our global commitments towards less carbon economy, moving, you know, dealing with the carbon footprint. But anyway, let's move to WWF.
Thank you, Chairperson. So just to pick up on two points raised by honourable members. So the one thing is just to clarify that WWF works with both business and labour. And while we have a mandate to look after interests of society and the environment, we don't have a material interest in which way the outcome comes. So I wouldn't like us to be painted into a corner of we on one end of the scale and business is on another end. We work very closely with business. So the one comment was about the growth projections and emissions that are linked to such growth, you know, while we still have a very carbon-intensive economy. So when all these discussions are about, you know, we're still below our own goals that we've set for ourselves, the trajectory we've set for ourselves, one example of how heavy emitters have managed to sort of push this debate in their own interests is that our domestic policy commitment is for a range. And when we say we are still below our domestic policy commitment, we are below the top end of the range. And the top end of the range has long been contested as to whether it is an adequate level of ambition. So let us just be cautious in even using, you know, we are way over our own commitment to ourselves if we look at the middle or the bottom end of the range. So just a caution around that. And anyway, every country all around the world has to be net carbon neutral by 2050. Or Africa is looking at temperature increases of 3 to 4 degrees Celsius. Then another example is around, you know, the job issue, which, you know, I will stand shoulder to shoulder with every mine worker to not lose one job, because dependent on every single job is 10 other people. But I think we are doing workers a disservice if we continue to allow what is actually a sort of 20th century type of economy based on colonialism and apartheid of extract primary resources and ship them overseas, whereas the new low-carbon economy allows for opportunities of localization of industry in South Africa, opens up a whole new area of businesses that, in a sense, we are not allowing to flourish because we are directing the resources of the economy into these kind of rearguard directions. And Sasol, in a recent... I'm picking on you today. In a recent press statement, spoke that, you know, if they have to pay tax at the 120 rand a ton rate, that would cost them 1 billion of their profits. Firstly, we're paying 6 rand a ton, not 120, after you take off all the rebates. So that 1 billion is 2% of their tax before, as their profits before tax of 52 billion. So, I mean, certainly if I was a shareholder, I wouldn't be happy about giving away 1% or 2% of the profits. But this is what the nation hands the liquid fuel sector, not just Sasol, the whole sector. In fossil fuel subsidies, they receive between 7 and 29 billion rand a year in direct subsidies, and we exempt them from paying over money to the tune of 35 million to 5 billion through indirect subsidies measures. So, you know, if these heavy emitters want to argue that it's a big piece of their before-tax profits, okay, fine, you know, just hand us back the subsidies then. We'll stop supporting you while also, you know, taxing you to a much lower degree. So I think we really have to be cautious about, you know, the jobs argument is used mischievously, and I think that Treasury has well explained the kinds of plans that are being made about creating new jobs and about protecting workers in existing industries. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Did I see a hand? Okay. Let's get Treasury then to comment. But I think it's a good debate. But what is becoming very clear is that other issues are not as contentious as the alignment on the carbon budgets and the carbon tax. Maybe that where the problem is that that's where it's going to hit in the pocket. And that's the major area of contestation. And I think it's something that probably we might have to accept as we agree to disagree at the end of the day. But Treasury, you can comment on there's a department where you're taking notes. I think there were some questions for Dia as well.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to respond broadly to some of the issues raised, but just to remind ourselves why we're here and why we have this carbon tax proposal. We're seeking to give effect to the polluter pays principle. The main aim of this tax is to put a price on those emissions, because those emissions are not currently priced, and it's a policy principle that we operate in from. It's aiming to correct a market failure. It's starting at a very, very low rate, as we've heard, if you're looking at the high-level panel proposals. And its intention is to correct that market failure, put a price on emissions, and over time, as we move forward, adjust that rate to create those incentives for reducing emissions. The second objective within that is that once you're correcting that market failure, you can't go straight away for a fully internalizing those costs. It's too high. But we've got to start somewhere, and we've accepted our responsibility as a global citizen to actually address these emissions. So secondly, it's once you have these prices in, it's creating those price signals, not just for producers to change behavior, but also for consumers to start thinking about alternatives. And I think it's important for us to remember that. It will go some way in helping us achieve our targets that we've set ourselves. But by itself, it's not going to help us, and at the rate currently proposed, it will need to be complemented by other instruments, and it will need to be adjusted over time. We have done a modeling study, and there's been several modeling studies done. Most of them CGE modeling studies, because that is a model that measures the impact of a shock to the economy through a tax. And our modeling has been done through the World Bank and bringing in international experts. And it does show that the tax would lead to a decrease in emissions. But there's also various assumptions that is built into that model that is important to note, that this model does not take into account all of the allowances. It doesn't take into account the carbon offset allowance. It doesn't take into account the performance allowance. So at the minimum, it's likely to overestimate the impacts on GDP. It does not take into account the benefits of the shift that we would need to, that we would make. It doesn't take into account the benefits of a one-ton reduction in emissions and it doesn't take into account the benefits of reducing local air pollution by one ton. And local air pollution is an important co-benefit of actually reducing carbon dioxide emissions, because the individuals that are actually impacted by emissions of local air pollution are the people that are living in the vicinity of power stations. It's sulfur dioxide emissions. Those costs to actually treat illnesses that they suffer from is borne by the state. And that's one of the benefits that is not built into the modeling. As part of our modeling and all the modeling that has been done, what was one of the key elements that has informed the design of the tax is that what is done with the revenue in the modeling. And the model did look at very broad-based recycling of the revenue, so where it goes back into production. And it also looked at very narrow-based recycling of where you use the money for renewable energy, etc. And what it does show is that the broad-based recycling would have a lower impact on the economy in terms of GDP growth. If you're looking at the current design of the tax, it has elements of both broad-based recycling and very narrow-based recycling. And the broad-based recycling is through this commitment to electricity price neutrality in the first phase, which effectively reduces the electricity generation levy to zero for the first phase. Obviously, we will review this, which we've committed to do, around 2020 for the second phase of what happens with the electricity generation levy. All the modeling studies that have been undertaken to date through the World Bank, through the Treasury, through the initial long-term mitigation scenarios work that was initiated by the Department of Environmental Affairs back in 2006, all of the modeling shows that when you introduce a carbon tax, it can help contribute to emission reductions and minimize impacts on GDP, especially in the context of recycling those revenues. And we've taken all of that into account in the design of this tax. As we move forward, I think one of the questions was around, why don't you earmark the revenues? When you look at all of these allowances, from 60 to 95%, you're looking at a tax on the margin of only 5%. We are not looking at a lot of revenue. So if you have to say earmark revenues if you're looking at in currently at around maybe 10 billion, one of the challenges with earmarking is that it doesn't allow you, you have access to that revenue stream, but it may not be sufficient for you to actually address the objectives you want to address. If you're looking at this low carbon transition that we need to make, it's not small change that we need. It is using money to channel into the big sectors that can actually drive real reductions in emissions. So the challenges of earmarking is that it might provide a certain revenue source, but it does not provide, the danger is it would not provide enough revenue for the goals that you actually set yourself. So earmarking, it's two sides of it.
And, you know, it's holy grail in the treasury. We don't like earmarking. And the ones we have are really bad examples. We've got the road accident fund, which the incentive structure then is completely wrong. But I think more importantly, you don't want to
You must bring us money for the plastic levy back to the environment.
No, we're coming with plastics.
Excuse me, it's irregular to fight your scoff. You telling us off about how we function. We have no choice. If you were decent members here, you know, we'll be fine. So similarly, you're not allowed to raise this.
But we do need to move in a much stronger way on plastics as well. They're destroying our fish and our life cycle and water quality. Yeah. But I think just the other question which Andrew asked is an important one, which is, you know, climate change does require globally coordinated action. And that's why the COP process, I forget the number now for Poland, is so important, and of course, I think whenever you have globally coordinated action, I mean, certainly in my recent life in my recent life, I mean, to see the global financial crisis really required globally coordinated action, and the world certainly did come together on that. And you hope, you know, sure there are setbacks. Sure, the U.S. pulling out of Paris is a big setback. But, you know, companies, cities, states are still working to change. And part of it is as they planning for their future scenarios, customers are checking, you know, how much do you emit. Financial institutions are also under pressure, even from their regulators, that if they are over-invested in what are called standard assets, that, you know, more capital may be required and so on. So even in countries and like the U.S., I think that they, and just a report released last week, just shows you the progress that is being made despite the late night Twitter, okay? And then I think as you get to, and certainly I think as you get to countries like Brazil too, I think that there's whole issues around the Amazon and deforestation, and the incoming president doesn't seem very committed to climate change. So there are setbacks. But does that mean that we don't proceed? And it's a question of how you still get others into the net. And importantly, I think it does, there's a lot of innovation going on in the world around this. I mean, just reading that energy transition report, they're saying they see the world becoming even more reliant on electricity as an energy source. Now, you know, on the one hand, you want clean electricity, but we probably, I mean, our cars are going to be using electricity and not fossil fuels as you look into the future. That's going to be a huge change, and probably in usage patterns as well. So I think those are the challenges that we need to look at. So we can't answer all these questions because it's hard to look into the future, but I think that these are some of the trends we have to take into account. I think just a question on sequestration and renewables. I mean, let me just say on renewables, yes, I think that we do need more certainty going beyond 2022, and certainly that's the way we're going to go. And I do say to our hardworking colleague from ESCOM that they must also remember what government policy is. And they need to also, certainly I think that there was resistance the last few years, but I do think that that mindset is changing within ESCOM. The question is it changing fast enough? We'll help to accelerate that process. But on sequestration.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. On sequestration, we have the national reporting regulations for greenhouse gases. And in there, there are provisions for reporting on sequestration. However, what has been missing so far is the modalities and rules on how you manage that. Because, for example, if you look at plantations, if you're going to be planting and harvesting, you cannot really prove that you are sequestering. So there needs to be rules to safeguard the integrity of the scheme. So those are the rules that we are developing, working with the sectors that are affected. That should be concluded before March next year.
Thanks. On renewables, we made a policy commitment to electricity price neutrality, and that included both the electricity levy and the renewable energy premium that's built into the electricity tariff, and that was to apply to the first phase. And the reason for that was because there was views of potential double taxation. What we have said is that we will review that electricity price neutrality before the end of the first phase, where we can provide further certainty going forward. There is also the possibility that we need to bear in mind that these two instruments can operate in isolation, and they are two separate instruments. And that's the point of view that we're coming from. If you're looking at renewables, wind and solar, it's basically cost competitive with coal currently. So we will need to look, if we do continue with this renewable energy premium credit beyond the first phase, we will basically need to review the the interaction of the policy.
Okay, just to wrap up, maybe on global efforts to reduce emissions. There is a COP next week. I was hoping that the Department of Environmental Affairs will speak to this issue, because it is not entirely true that because the Trump administration has made a policy announcement to get out of the Paris Agreement, and then the U.S. is not participating. The U.S. negotiators are participating. They will be there in Poland next week. They are not as prominent as they used to be. The states in the U.S. are committed to the Paris Agreement. They are participating as different states. In fact, they are pushing much more ambition than other countries. So the U.S. is still part of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, participating there, pushing much more ambition at the level of the states. Look, the impact of the our negotiators are telling us at the climate change conference, they are telling us that the real impact of this policy decision by Trump will get realized if Trump gets the second term. If he doesn't, this thing is just going to fizzle away, because the system is built in such a way that you put a notice if you want to get out of the Paris Agreement, and that can only take effect 2 years down the line. And now they're still negotiating getting out of the Paris Agreement. But the U.S. Negotiators are still there. The only thing is that they are not taking the lead, which in the past, well, it used to help, because when you've got big countries taking the lead during the presidency of Obama, because Obama was the fact that we had the Paris Agreement coming into effect sooner than what was anticipated was because of he was acting as a catalyst. He was acting as a his presidency together with Xi Jinping of China. China very much part of the Paris Agreement. They are also coming to the party in terms of raising the levels of ambitions. Together with the other parties, South Africa is part of the BRICS countries. Together with China, they are committed to reducing emissions. So it's not true that there are no global efforts. They are there. Members can go to Poland next week. In fact, they are on another level now in terms of the negotiations. There is acceptance in the world about this. There is a report now of the IP, this scientific panel on 0.5. Or on 1.5. We think that they are going to push their countries into coming up with much more commitments at the next round of negotiations. Some of the stakeholders who are here, they participate in those negotiations as part of the country delegation. So it's one team. But I just want to say that it's quite clear from that discussion that there's nothing new that has been introduced. In fact, what has been put on the table is something that seeks to address some of the concerns that were raised. Now, the sticking point, of course, is around carbon budget and carbon tax, and which, to some extent, I think Treasury has been able to try and address those kind of concerns. The climate change bill is still before the cabinet processes. It's going to be approved and then it will come back to parliament. And once it comes to parliament, it gets approved, then there is a commitment from Treasury then to revise the carbon tax, some of the provisions in the carbon tax, to allow for that alignment between the carbon, the climate change bill in respect of the carbon budgets and the carbon tax. So that commitment is there, that alignment will take place at that point. As I was saying, honorable members, colleagues, I think we need to get finality on this instrument because it has been 10 years in discussion and we can't postpone it again. The cost of postponing this piece of instrument that is seeking to change the behaviors in the industry, we can't afford it. Not at this stage where we are. Now, the lady from WWF was talking about the impact. If it is 1.5 in the world, in Africa it's more. So the impact of climate change are felt much more in Africa than in other parts of the world. So we have to be responsible as one of the countries in Africa who are the worst emitters in the continent. We must take actions. We must lead by example. So I think the sooner the Carbon Tax Act is enacted, the better, so that we can then move towards mitigating the effects of climate change in our country. So I think that's that for today. I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Honorable Karim, just to talk about the process going forward. I have agreed with him that we'll be part of the first part of the processing of this bill next week, Tuesday. We are supposed to deal with the minimum emission standards on air quality next week, which is also emissions. And, you know, it's quite interesting sitting here looking at the behavior of business, especially the big polluters. Even when we discuss air quality, we have the same contestation around reducing the emissions, complying with the minimum emission standards, retrofitting the operation so that there is less emission, there is less pollution. Because this pollution at the end of the day, like you're saying, is affecting the ordinary citizens. We were shown a map around the world of where there is a lot of concentration of pollution. And Mpumalanga is one area where our people there are exposed to high levels of pollution by industry. And there's been an introduction of the minimum emission standards for industry to comply, and we're still struggling with compliance. They are rolling postponement, they are applying for postponements year after year. And we've said that there must be a point where these postponements must come to an end. There must be compliance. Because we can't continue to postpone this compliance with the standards that we seek to put. So it's an accepted way that there will always be contestation about what we seek to do to protect the health of our people. And in this instance, to live up to our global commitments. Anyway, let me not go on and on. Karim, and hand over to you.
Okay, thank you. Firstly, ideally, we should have finalized this bill and voted on it before the COP summit. We agree, but it's impossible. With the legislative load we've got in finance and the others, it's impossible. We've produced too many bills. In fact, just to alert you, in IPSIT report, we want this committee split. I don't think we'll get our way into two committees.
one that deals with legislation, one that deals with oversight. But let's see what the powers that we can't manage under the current circumstances. But firstly, what we welcome from Treasury is a commitment to meet on Friday. In fact, we're going to propose it, right? So that you settle your issues. You get a NEDLAC also meeting on Thursday. Can you finalize things, please? I've asked the chair, I'll speak to Mr. Velakazi, Alan, you'll pursue me with that. Secondly, we don't approve of Treasury or the stakeholders giving NEDLAC reports. NEDLAC must speak for itself. Because invariably what happens is government will give you one take and the stakeholders another. So surprise, surprise. You know, there's now a difference of interpretation of what happened in NEDLAC. This happens all the time. We're bored with it. It's just that NEDLAC needs to finalize things. Let NEDLAC speak for itself. So that must happen. That's the first item on the agenda next Tuesday. Then the meeting on Tuesday will also get a report. You see, we can use Treasury, but your government, we're not saying you're misrepresenting anything, Treasury. We must do our job. So it's for Parliament to decide whether what is here is new or not. So the Standing Committee on Finance, in consultation with the content advisors and researchers, will go through the bill, and we will confer over the weekend on whether we think, as a parliamentary committee, there is anything new. I can't see it, but it's not for the executive or the civil society or business stakeholders here to tell us whether there's something new or not. It's for us to hear both sides and for Parliament to decide. So that falls in the circle. His leadership, Antonia, is here, and obviously the relevant people from the Portfolio Committee on Environment. Then we're saying that we will go through, as chairs of the committee, as our obligation, we will go through all your submissions. In short, it is unfair to expect people to make submissions and not read them. So we will, in fact, do that. In a parallel way, I'll do it over the weekend anyway, I haven't got time for that. In a parallel way, Antonio and Zakele and the colleagues from the Standing the Portfolio Committee on Environment will go through your submissions. They will only identify new things. And we're unapologetic about it because we explained to you there's no legal obligation, nor are there any rules that say that you should keep coming to the parliamentary committee. So though we have no obligation, this is the norm by which our committee operates. When the term ends, the new committee can come and decide whether it wants to have what we call a transmission conveyor belt system. You know, public hearings, where people come and make a submission. They even leave before anybody else speaks, they answer their questions. After an hour, they leave. The Standing Committee on Finance doesn't think it should be a dialogue. So when our term ends in May, the next committee can decide whether they want to have. There's no rule that defines the way we operate. In fact, the Portfolio Committee Environment operates with those rules. But we hope the rules will change. Some of us have been arguing for that since 1998. But nothing stops us from doing what the committee does. And other committees have seen what we do. They're also seeking to do that. But that's a matter for the Sixth Parliament to deal with. Then to say that when you come next week, if you so choose to do, talking to your civil society players here, you also have to raise new things. It's for the committee chairs, ultimately. That's our job, to rule on what is new. As far as members who are new, can I plead with you to confer with your researchers who sit here all the time? Or confer with Alan and go through the meetings we've had since last year. Was it January we started, right? Because it is unfair each time a new member comes in, and that's the way this committee operates, Standing Committee of Finance, to raise issues that have been covered exhaustively before. The job of a new member is to catch up. But nothing stops us within that parameter of allowing some people to raise. It depends on what's being raised and so on, because it's always useful to hear a new voice on an old issue. So the chairs, that's the job of a chair, to find a balance between the two. So that also applies to you. If you come next, you might raise something you've raised before. We might give you some latitude. But don't use a new form of the same issue that we've already exhausted. I think the chair summarized where we are. This is the playing field, as it were. Because otherwise we're getting back to day one. And that's not fair. We've had endless hours of discussions. We need to alert you, too, that outside of meetings, we do engage. We engage with some of you. We bump into you. But we also engage. We read also. Right? So what I'm saying to you is that we are now reaching a stage where we have to take decisions. So next week's meeting will start with NEDLAC first making an input, then Treasury giving us a report on the meetings that have been had with you, where you must settle these issues. That's why we ask them to meet, you know, outside meetings. Otherwise, we'll spend thousands of hours here. But finally, government has the right to come with its policies, and Parliament has a right to decide. We don't expect you to arrive at consensus and come with something and we're going to agree. It just makes it easier. We can say no to you even if you agree. But I would say finish all these issues by Friday, come next Tuesday. These colleagues, they have to go and do other work. So for 1.5 hours, we've agreed. Thanks for your indulgence. We'll finalize the policy issues. Then we will start line by line going through the bills. If all goes well, we would like Treasury by Wednesday 1 o'clock to have finished the line by line. But then we'll have to do a report on the bill, and we're incapable with our commitments and our limited resources of doing that by next Wednesday. So when we come back, the first sitting, Alan, the first sitting will be finalization of this bill and possible voting. But I will draft a program. So the first item will be, so we'll put it on the agenda of the program for Parliament. Then it must go to the NCOP. On the matter of I've been previously given a mandate at least 4 times. I'm going to do it again. I'd like to say that notwithstanding what some members may say, I can only tell you what my intention is. And I think most of the members of the committee agree. It is not to be derogatory or pejorative of business. It is truly understandable that Sasol will take the positions it does. As Momo said, business will obviously have reservations and opposition to this bill. The NGOs that are active in this area, I'm not talking of WWF alone, and the unions will also have their issues. Right? So it is a function of where we are. It's not about individuals here. And you're doing your job as business. And we'll compliment you for that. But ultimately, as the co-chair said, we all have to work together towards a common goal. And he set it out. I'm not going to cover that ground. But what Parliament needs to think about, the sixth term of Parliament, for those of you who will be here, Parliament needs to make available, Comrade Mopolani is much younger than me, so maybe I'm addressing you more than most. Parliament has to make available more funding so that we have people here beyond the powerful stakeholders, big business, big trade unions like COSATU, big NGOs that are resourced. What about the smaller entities that can never come to Cape Town? Now, ideally, my own view is that if there wasn't the time, if there was the time and we weren't under the pressures of the end of the fifth term of Parliament, ideally the NCOP committee should take this bill into the provinces and the provincial legislature take it to the people. Not in the way you're presenting it or they argue against it. This is something that interests you more. It's to simplify the issues of the environment. To use this bill, like maybe you can use your bill, climate, yeah, there's an opportunity, climate, I can't describe to you, is to take this bill through the NCOP, your bill, climate change bill, climate act bill, is it?
Climate change bill.
Take it to the people. You can't discuss it with people in Shilumayo, Ikuvukeni, you know, the text of a difficult bill. What you can deal with is the issues, because it affects all of us, and use it to mobilize people to save resources. So, ideally, you know, Momo, you may not like this. I know you want bills fast, you know. It's not going to happen up till May. Hopefully the next person that's here, you can persuade that. Ideally, if I had my own way, Comrade, we should urge the NCOP to do this, but it's not going to happen. So, having said that, we want to thank everybody from our side. We want to thank in particular Comrade Mapulane and comrades and colleagues from the Portfolio Committee Environment. We know we straining your time. We know we're not used to this method, but you're going to be here for the first half. We need you for policy issues, and then we can let you go. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, Chair.